Hey, Dad.
What, Logan?
What did the child say when an energy drink rolled under his mattress?
I have no idea.
Dad, there's a monster under my bed.
You are so wrong. I am taking all your magic cards and throwing them in the trash.
That's rude.
You're rude.
You're listening to The Wayward Willis with John and Logan, where two atheists discuss religion, culture, and maybe some politics. If you're offended by blasphemy, profanity, or you hate fun, this podcast may not be right for you. And now, on to the show.
Before the show this week, I'd like to point everybody to a listener survey that I created to help us get input from our listeners on what they do and don't like about the show. If you could fill it out and share it, we'd really appreciate it because it'll help us make this podcast the best podcast that we possibly can. Now on to the show.
Hey, you.
It's us.
We're not saying we're involved in insider trading, but it's probably time to dump your stocks in aluminum foil.
I'm your unlucky host, John.
And I'm Logan, but only when your mom isn't around. Then I'm Logan.
Ew, I have a bad feeling about this episode, since I just broke 13 mirrors with my open umbrella underneath a ladder inside a witch's house. But we'll do it anyway.
Fuck it! We'll do it live!
We're talking about superstition.
So, what even is superstition?
It's a hit Stevie Wonder song from 1972. When you believe in things you don't understand, then you suffer. Superstition ain't the way. Really, though, the dictionary defines superstition as a widely held but unjustified belief in supernatural causation leading to certain consequences of an action or event or a practice based on such a belief. Basically, it's inventing a reason not to change your socks for the playoffs, even though we all know you're not changing your socks because you're dirty and lazy, Chuck.
There's a reason your socks have holes in them, buddy. This is an intervention.
You know, I'd like to think we're justified in billing this podcast as skeptical, even though you won't budge on your pro-unicorn stance.
Look, it's not a stance. It's a scientific fact. That's like asking the band members of Twisted Sister to take it. Spoiler alert, they're not gonna take it.
But since our primary focus is religion, you may be asking yourself why we're talking about superstition instead of Jesus crackers and magic underwear.
I'm not. Nothing surprises me anymore.
You've become so cynical.
Well, when your life is a vicious cycle of built-up hope and subsequent perpetual disappointment, you get a little jaded, okay?
Oof, that's rough, man.
Yeah.
Regardless, superstition touches on religion as well, and an alternate definition of the word is excessively credulous belief in and reverence for supernatural beings. Again, we have a Venn diagram here where all religions are superstitions, but not all superstitions are religious. The word goes all the way back to the 13th century and was originally used to describe an irrational adherence to religious beliefs or occult practices like prophecy and attributing misfortune to invisible entities. Superstition's root word is stand, as in, I stand firm to my belief that Logan put a curse on me with his magic cards, and that's why I've been losing every game of words with friends. It's not me, it's you.
I put a spell on you, and now you're mine.
Superstitions are based in fear. Whether it's the fear of the unknown or the fear of the known, the irrational behavior resulting from these superstitions is intended to avert, allay, or avoid the fear.
Oh, could you not think of any other A words?
Well, I'm thinking of asshole right now.
Point taken.
Moving on. Because the fear is irrational, the behaviors usually are as well. Sometimes there's a sense of confirmation that a ritual or a specific act can change an unknown outcome to a known outcome.
If I devour the entire pizza whenever I order one, I don't get attacked by relentless torture demons. Therefore, I guess I'm supposed to eat the entire pizza whenever I order one if I want to continue not being attacked by relentless torture demons.
You are so science, and you don't even know it. Now, I'm ordering a pizza.
Good. Do it.
At the beginning of this episode, I mentioned Chuck and his dirty, stinky socks. Gross, Chuck. Gross! Anyway, at some point, he may have forgotten to change his socks, and he ended up winning the next game. To him, this can mean that the act of wearing disgusting socks increases, if not guarantees, his chances of winning.
Probably because the opposing team can smell his socks all the way from his living room, and they couldn't play with both hands because one was constantly being used to plug their noses.
You are not wrong.
Fuck you, Chuck.
Because if it happened once, it's definitely a consistent and reliable phenomena. Science! Anyway, now Chuck is convinced that his superstitious behavior is warranted, and he'll keep making everyone else's lives uncomfortable with his rancid foot stench. Thanks, Chuck.
Fucking Chuck. Here, have a $20 gift card at Kohl's. Not because I love you, but because I love breathing untainted oxygen.
Jeez, $20 at Kohl's gets you like one sock. Send that bastard to Walmart.
Nailed it.
There are a lot of non-sock-based superstitions with dubious origin stories.
Which implies there are lots of other sock-related superstitions.
That might actually be. But sometimes they just don't have any explanation at all. But that doesn't stop people from subscribing to them. Throwing salt over your shoulder if you spill it, for example. Why would you do that? I don't know. Neither does anyone else. But some people say the devil lurks over your left shoulder while exerting his evil influence and throwing salt into his eyes thwarts his agenda of wasting seasonings. Good plan, devil. World domination is just around the corner.
Why aren't more people inventing salt blast cannons to just constantly shove the devil's eyes full of salt? Everyone else is light years behind me on the learning curve here. I've got this.
I feel like you're still behind because I have a shirt made out of salt right now.
Oh my god. This man is a genius.
It's a salt hoodie.
Oh, God.
Also, this is just discriminatory against left-handed people, because it assumes you're picking up a pinch of salt with your right hand and throwing over your left shoulder. Can you imagine trying to make a precise throw into the devil's face with your left hand over your left shoulder? You'd look like an alien trying to explain an earthling high school dance to the Hive Queen.
That was the best simile you could come up with. I'm taking you to enroll in an improv class sometime.
I need one. Also, if your significant other likes to walk up behind you and give you hugs while you're cooking, you stand a high chance of blinding them, or, at the very least, making them wonder if you think they're the devil. Talk about putting a strain on a relationship.
You don't have a good relationship if you don't continuously believe that your partner is the devil. That's how that works, right? Have I been doing it wrong all these years?
Yes.
Damn.
Confirmed. If we were to run down the list of common superstitions, we likely wouldn't be telling anybody something they don't already know. You've got 7 years of bad luck for breaking a mirror, good luck for finding a four-leaf clover, bad luck for walking under a ladder, or good luck through hacking limbs off of bunnies. This last one is ridiculous because that bunny had a rabbit's foot with them their entire life, and look where it got them. Good luck charm debunked.
Holy shit, that paradigm shift was palpable.
There are so many superstitions revolving around luck because luck in itself is a superstition. The belief in luck, good or bad, stems from fear of the unknown.
And fear of elder things, if you ask H.P. Lovecraft.
If a person is subject to random chance or what they perceive to be unseen forces, then they feel powerless and out of control. The development of ritual or myths around luck is a way of coping with the reality that you won't always succeed, and at the same time, finding a way to blame misfortune on something other than yourself.
You can't be bad at everything if nothing is your fault. That's why whenever your League of Legends teammates feed kills to the enemy team, it's always because of lag. Get good, scrubs.
Yeah, that.
Nailed it.
Humans are odd in that they want to have control over their lives, but at the same time feel comforted knowing that it's someone else's fault when something bad happens to them. A more consistent view would be that everything that happens, happens because of your choices and actions. Personal responsibility! Bootstraps! It's the American dream!
I swear to God, if you say bootstraps one more time, I'm probably gonna kill you.
Boot... laces?
You're walking a fine line, boyo!
Some superstitions are based around fortune rather than luck. Things like astrology, birthstones, and the zodiac attempt to classify and characterize people so their path through life seems predictable, based on nothing more than the time of year they're born and/or the location of Earth and its orbit relative to known stars and planets in our galaxy. If you buy into your zodiac sign, you can build a sort of personality profile of yourself and blame the stars when everyone thinks you're an antisocial asshole because you're a Scorpio and can't help being resentful and obstinate.
Hey man, blame the stars. They're the ones who made me steal your ice cream.
What?
Nothing.
Okay, moving on. So why do Scorpios get a bad rep anyway?
Probably because they're always shouting, "Get over here!" and tugging you from across the map, fucking...
Oh, that's a sweet Mortal Kombat reference, bro.
Thanks, Pam.
But all the other signs are like, compassionate and caring. But Scorpio is like, you're gonna die alone, weeping over the ancient sins of your ancestors. It's like whoever wrote the Zodiac personality types had a feud with someone who was born in early November and was like, obviously these people are dicks. The end.
Oh, and there was a unicorn. The end.
Leave Pauly. Take the cannoli.
I feel like I make that reference a lot, and anyone who listens to the show who hasn't seen that one specific episode of The Amanda Show probably just attributes it to my undying adoration for unicorns.
But let's be honest, they could just do that anyway.
I mean, yeah, they wouldn't be wrong, but it is a reference.
So here's where I admit to subscribing to a stupid, nonsense, superstitious practice for no apparent reason. I mean, the reason would be that it's a rule, but I don't even know where the rule comes from. It's about fortune cookies.
Oh God, I know where this is going, and I'm already dying on the inside.
From laughter?
No, from pain and suffering. Smite me where I stand, God, my body is ready for you.
That's what she said.
Oh God.
So when you eat a fortune cookie, you don't immediately rip the fortune out of it and read it. You have to eat the entire cookie first without looking at the fortune. Then, if you read the fortune after that, it's more likely to come true. I'm not saying it will actually come true, I'm just saying that's the rule. Like, the 5-second rule doesn't save you from harmful bacteria and the scorn of your peers, but it is a rule. Anyway, the fortune cookie rule is one I play along with because, whatever. And there's always the supplementary rule that you have to put the words in bed after the fortune. Good times.
Yeah, you're fired. Go home.
But I am home.
Well, go to your second home.
My vacation home in the Hamptons?
No, the sewer.
Some other superstitions are based on ignorance of the natural world and how it works. For example, toads give you warts. This is a very common misunderstanding of a natural occurrence that probably hails way back to before germ theory and the discovery of viruses. Toads don't actually give you warts.
Right. Frogs do.
No, they don't.
Oh, I mean salamanders.
Nope.
Oh, newts?
Not even close.
Very small rocks.
This has gotten entirely too silly.
Burn her anyway!
Warts are actually caused by HPV, it turns out. The H stands for human, so unless a toad is the result of a witch's curse on a prince, you don't need to be afraid of toads.
Well, I guess what we learned today is that it's totally okay to make out with frogs. Just be sure to ask first. It would be rude otherwise.
It's toads.
You said that frogs don't give warts either. Fuck you!
Oh, shit. You right.
Yeah, that's stupid. Go away.
Another silly superstition I ran across in my research is that putting an acorn on your windowsill can protect you from lightning. I don't even know what to say about this one, except that if gods control lightning, they must have tree nut allergies. No peanut butter for you, Zeus! Get that shit out of my lunchroom!
What is Zeus afraid of more than anything?
Oh God, is this a joke? I don't know. What is he afraid of?
These nuts? Ha! Got he!
Regardless, even if this saves you from lightning, it is not going to save you from squirrels. They're hungry, they're mean, and you're fucked.
By the squirrels? This seems like some off-brand Disney porn kind of thing, and I'm not sure I'm totally against it either.
Take me, squirrels! My body is ready for you!
I'm not touching that.
That's what she said.
Up top. Speaking of gods, superstitions that revolve around religion can be sillier than the religion itself. Or maybe just as silly.
Stop being so silly!
For example, there's a superstition that at midnight on Christmas Eve, animals can spontaneously learn to speak your language in order to proclaim the birth of Jesus. This is stupid on multiple levels.
That's the punchline to the John in an elevator joke. Oh shit, roasted as fuck!
I don't like you. So first, animals don't fucking talk, Chuck. It just doesn't happen. No matter how many times you whip your donkey, it's not going to try and reason with you. I mean, it might turn around at some point during your trip and ask you to change your goddamn socks, you dirty piece of crap.
Wow. Okay, look, I hate the smell of Chuck's feet just as much as the next guy, but damn, lay off him, all right?
Okay. But Bible stories aside, I think we've ruled out talking snakes and donkeys. Second, December 25th is not Jesus' actual birthday. That's my birthday, so quit trying to co-opt my culture, you damn imperialist oppressors!
Historical misappropriation!
The prevailing opinion among scholars is that he was born in June of 2 BCE or October of 7 BCE based on computer models of confluences of comets and planets that could have been interpreted to have been slow-moving stars. Get your shit together, Christians!
That was some next-level stuff right there.
I know, right? Some superstitions have an ominous meaning. You've probably heard about when your ears burn or itch, it's because someone's talking about you. But there's also one that says if you get a shiver, it's because someone's casting a shadow over your grave. This one has to have a very old origin, because it's really not as common nowadays for people to buy or plan burial plots well in advance of their death.
And if someone you know does that, you should probably direct them to the nearest ice cream parlor, because that person clearly needs a friend.
Fact. I mean, it still happens, of course, but not with a procrastinator like me. I figure I'm just going to go out in a massive fireball and leave you boys with a mountain of debt. You're welcome.
Talk about icing on the cake, am I right?
You are correct. Anyway, I have to wonder if it ever occurred to anyone that they're shivering because they're cold. Anyone? No? Okay.
Miss me with that logic shit.
So, because most superstitions are based in fear, it would be easy to conflate them with phobias.
Your mom is conflated with phobias? Oh shit, son!
How dare you! You know my mom is a phobia!
Oh shit. I'm sorry, man.
But again, we have a Venn diagram with superstitions and phobias in two circles just barely touching, like a set of testicles.
You seem to be an expert on this subject. Oh, roasted again! Man, I'm on a roll today.
Some phobias are superstitions, and some superstitions are phobias, but not all of both are both.
Truly, you have a dizzying intellect.
Wait till I get going! Now, where was I?
Iocane.
Oh, yes. So this week is a perfect example of a mixed phobia and superstition, because we just had a Friday the 13th. This superstition slash phobia is called frigatriskaidekaphobia, which is different from friggin' trisket phobia. That's the fear of weird stringy crackers and the preference of Wheat Thins instead.
Wheat Thins are trashed here. Honestly, so are Triscuits. Invest in some cheese nips, my friends. They're truly an underrated cracker.
I really prefer the rainbow goldfish.
What the fuck is wrong? Get out of my house.
They're so good.
Get out.
Fine, I'm leaving. I'm taking my ball with me.
Your
balls. Anyway, the number 13 has always had a dark cloud hanging over it through no fault of its own.
Unlike 7, homeboy 8, 9.
You are going to have to get another room because you are double grounded.
Can I just get a room inside my pre-existing room?
Yo, dog, I put a room in your room so you can go to your room while you're in your room.
A classic.
So there are a couple of ideas out there that have to do with religion. First of all, it's presumed that at the Last Supper of Jesus Christ, Judas was the 13th and last disciple to sit down at the table. And then he heckin' bamboozled Jesus with a kiss and got him unalived.
You have the best words.
I know. There's no scriptural basis for this, though. It's just conjecture and confirmation bias.
And impeccable grammar.
Thank you, sir. The second idea is that there are 13 full moons in a year instead of 12. Because you wouldn't expect that. It's spooky and you should fear it. Ooh, the moon's gonna get ya.
Shit, man, now I'm shaking in my boots.
Do they have straps?
Holy shit, I'm out.
Aw, lonely John.
Deuces!
But the moon's not really gonna get ya, because the moon didn't create the calendar. People did. You're just spooking yourselves, idiots!
Bork, bork, you are doing me a frighten.
There are several others, but I think my favorite is the Norse legend that 12 gods were sitting around, chilling, having a good time at a banquet. Apparently, a dozen gods is the perfect number of gods. But then Loki shows up, uninvited, like the dickhole he is, and arranges for Balder the Beautiful to be shot with a poison arrow and kills him. Balder was the god of joy and happiness, and that's why everything sucks and being a grown-up makes me sad.
Hashtag relatable posts.
There's no unified theory as to why Friday the 13th is an unlucky day, except to say that 13 is an unlucky number, so go fuck yourself.
Is the implication that Friday the 13th is the penultimate day for masturbation?
Penultimate? Well, what would be the ultimate day for masturbation?
April 1st, when Pornhub changes their entire site to Cornhub or Hornhub or something else that rhymes with porn?
You're not wrong, but let's be honest, every day is the ultimate day for masturbation.
Nailed it. Literally. Okay, we're done.
All of these superstitions and phobias garner a lot of interest by skeptics and credulous people alike, just for different reasons. If we're all more rational about the things we don't know, and we're more committed to figuring them out than assigning supernatural causation to them, perhaps we could do away with superstitions and maybe even religion. A boy can dream.
You know, Martin Luther King Jr. had a dream once. I feel like yours pales in comparison. Get on his level.
Oh, shit. Forget I said anything. I don't even deserve a dream.
You're damn right you don't know. Get back to scrubbing the floor, Cinderella.
No matter how your heart is grieving, if you keep on believing, the dream that you wish will come true.
Shut up.
Nailed it. I'm so happy to bring you this week's guest. She's a signer of the Humanist Manifesto, a board member of the FFRF, and the founder and president of the Freethought Society. It's my pleasure to introduce Margaret Downey.
Hello. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for reaching out to me, Jonathan.
Well, thank you so much for giving us some of your time and coming on the podcast. I know that we've been trying to work this out for the longest time, and I think maybe it all happened for the best because we have a wonderful topic this week.
Yes, one of my favorite topics, actually.
Excellent. So before we get into that, I just wanted to say that I met you at Gateway to Reason, Logan and I did, and we just fell in love with you, and so that's why we needed to get you on the podcast. But what I was wondering is, do you go to a lot of conventions and schmooze with people?
Yes, indeed. I actually have helped coordinate different conferences. Sometimes you never see my name associated with that particular conference, but I'm working in the background and helping secure speakers and helping with topics and suggesting things that would be of interest to the non-theist community, because some of your listeners probably don't know this, but I've been in the free thought movement for almost 30 years. So I kind of have my finger on the pulse of what is going on in the community and what the community wants to hear, would like to hear. I really enjoy reaching out to, you know, celebrities and scientists and other people that I've come to know throughout the 30 years and play a part in suggesting them to conference organizers and helping to actually firm up their bookings.
Well, good. I feel like that's a really important role. And, you know, just from having met you and what I know about you, I feel like you are a really good voice and a good person to fill those shoes.
Oh, thank you. I like to think of myself as a goodwill ambassador.
Because
I have been involved in every single major non-theist national group in some way or another. I sat on the board of the American Humanist Association. I've been, you know, intricately involved with the Center for Inquiry, the Freedom from Religion Foundation. I'm currently a board member. And I like to also help promote the smaller groups by sharing information and mentoring potential activists, potential spokespeople. I just love this, and I'm going to call it a job, but it's not really a job because I love it so much.
Right. Well, if you do something you love, then it doesn't feel so much like work, right?
Right. And, you know, I really think that that is how my career has changed, in that because I'm getting older, I've become more of a sage voice in the movement. Not so much anymore on television and on the radio, but I'm still in there trying to take younger people and help them understand what's important when you're reaching out to, say, the media, or you're trying to develop sound bites, talking points, you're trying to develop yourself as a group that is hosting some important topics. So all of this is because, yes, I am getting older, and that I'm not as involved as I was before. I would say what really did it for me was when I objected to the Ten Commandments being on the Chester County Courthouse. That was a federal case, and it involved so much work legally as well as activism. And I was the victim of quite a number of death threats, and the hate mail was just a horrendous thing for my family to endure. So I've taken kind of a back seat to some of the ongoing lawsuits, but I'm there as a consultation. I like to take a plaintiff and say, okay, this is what's going to happen. This is how you keep records. This is who you need to contact if you get a death threat. So, you know, I've been there, I've done that, and I want to help people as best I can to continue that work.
I can only imagine how difficult it would be to cope with all of that hatred and vitriol. I know, you know, other people that I've interviewed on this podcast have sort of been in the same situation, and it, my heart just goes out to them.
Have you ever considered becoming a plaintiff yourself, Jonathan?
When you ask that, what are you talking about?
Well, I like to advise potential plaintiffs to keep their eyes open for certain things, to be involved in the community and be a watchdog. Go to your city council meetings, go to your school board meetings, watch what happens in regards to separation of government and religion, and be ready with the possibility of filing a lawsuit to stop whatever infraction you spot that you're concerned with. And, you know, that's what I would encourage your listeners to do is to be involved, go to Planned Parenthood, do the things that you think are important to you. Don't take a stance of, well, I'll read about it in the paper, you know, someone else will take care of that. You know, it's up to each and every one of us to be on guard and watch for those infractions.
Right. And I've always wanted to try and take more of an activist role. And what would you say to people who would really love to do this kind of work, but they just don't feel like they have the time or the resources?
Well, I would say that if they really feel that they don't have the time, they can always donate money to someone who has the willpower to become a plaintiff through, you know, the ACLU. You can earmark donations to help with cases. For instance, here's a case I'll give you right now, Michael Newdow's case to take Under God out of the Pledge of Allegiance. You know, he's got a nonprofit and he's not charging any of his legal fees, but he has expenses. He has plaintiffs all over the country now asking the same thing in every district that we can, because this issue needs to go forward in every district so that it can eventually lead up to the Supreme Court.
Right. And that is definitely one thing that I would like to support, because, you know, my kid in high school says the Pledge of Allegiance every morning, which I've always just kind of been opposed to on the grounds of, like, that really seems like a weird, almost religious indoctrination of children to have them recite this thing every morning in unison like zombies.
Well, and it has become a prayer with the insertion of a capital G-O-D.
Right.
And it also has become a tool for discrimination, because if your child, who has every right to do this, chooses to sit out on this recitation, they are immediately scolded and placed into a category of anarchist and
right.
You know, and then discriminated against. But if we can prove that it is against our conscience to say that we believe in a God when we don't, then it can be moved to the original way that it was written, indivisible. You know, that's the way it should be said. But the insertion of the word God divides us.
Certainly. And, you know, even though the pledge still has the word indivisible in it, like you're saying, and you're absolutely right, that language, that religious language being inserted in there is a complete contradiction to the previous phrase. You know, just you say one thing and then you say the complete opposite then in the next second.
Right, right. Well, I am so pleased that these younger people who have experienced the shootings in the schools are getting their voice and saying, hey, no more thoughts and prayers. We're sick of hearing that. We want action.
Yes.
And that's a move in the right direction, because they're now questioning, you know, what is a thought? What is a prayer? That's nothing. what needs to happen is legislation and gun laws and consideration of the people who've been through the trauma, safety measures. There's, you know, this brand of new activism, I think, is very, very healthy for this country. We're finally going to do something.
I feel very encouraged by it, especially since it's coming from a generation that is now and within the next few years able to vote and exercise their voice and their rights to do the right thing.
Yes.
So speaking of the younger generation or younger people, your bio said that you arrived at the position of atheism in your 20s. And my listeners are always very interested in stories of how people came out of religion or what their experience early on with religion was. So could you talk just a little bit about how you arrived at that position?
Well, truth be told, I announced my atheism when I was 9 years old.
Oh my goodness.
So I announced it to my family and I became much more vocal about it in my teen years, challenging my fellow students, challenging my teachers, talking about atheism, reading, you know, Why I'm Not a Christian by Bertrand Russell over and over and over again. And so it was no surprise that when I saw religion causing harm in society, that's when I decided in my 20s to start speaking up publicly and defending the reputation of non-theists. My uncle was an atheist, so I could talk to him. But the first public atheist I ever saw and heard was Madeline Murray O'Hare. And I was thrilled that there was one other woman out there who had the audacity to speak about being a non-theist.
Right.
And it was so encouraging to me that I reached out to her. I reached out also to Ann Gaylor when she started the Freedom From Religion Foundation and, you know, made a connection there. I think it's important to find mentors, people that you can talk about your story to and you know, have that connection. At the Free Thought Society, we have a publication that 25 years ago, actually started printing journey stories. And we still collect them. They're very important to our publication. And we encourage people to do what I'm doing right now. Tell the story of the journey, how you got there. Even if it's a small journey, someone out there can relate to it, can connect to it, can be inspired by it. So if there are any listeners who would like to submit their journey story, we have an editorial team of 8 people who are excellent proofreaders, and they sharpen up stories so much that some of our writers have gone on to actually use their story to speak in public about their journey. But I'll just tell you quickly that my journey involved a lot of reading, a lot of questioning, a lot of support from people who said, yeah, yeah, you need to do that for us.
Okay.
Didn't want to do it, but I had their love and support that I needed to change the thinking of society. Back in my time, I sound really old now, but back in my time, being an atheist was something that, you know, could get you fired for and get you outed from your family activities. You'd lose friends. So it was a very difficult time. And I know things are better these days, but not so much. I mean, I still get those reports that someone's lost a job or the marriage is falling apart, or, you know, they're in school and they see an infraction and they say something and they get thrown out or put in detention. So, you know, there's still a lot of discrimination going on, and we like to keep track of that.
Right.
Yeah. By the way, I did start in 1993 a database called the Anti-Discrimination Support Network. And I was collecting stories of discrimination because I think that as a good atheist, When we claim that something is happening, we want proof.
Right, exactly.
So I was building this database that when I went on television and said, we are discriminated against. We're the most hated minority in America. Well, I wanted to be able to prove it, you know, with a database and stories and incidences and dates and times and proof and evidence.
Right.
And, so it went pretty well. It got kind of big, and I don't have a staff. So the Secular Coalition for America offered to adopt the program and take it off of my hands, and which would allow me to move on to do more things. And I was so pleased because they did it a fabulous job of putting everything online. So you can now go to the Secular Coalition for Reason and actually go to their tab, Anti-Discrimination Support Network, and you can enter the database into the database your particular story. And it's updated. It's a fabulous resource for professors who are looking at this, for the media, for our own networking. You know, there might be a story on there that could be very similar to someone else's story, and that they would be able to connect with someone and say, okay, what did you do? You know, how did you get out of this? Or what was your particular solution?
Right. And those kinds of things are the things that are so helpful for people who have just come out of religion or are trying to get out of religion or even considering or doubting their religion. And I think that I already have so many links that I want to share with our listeners. The show notes are going to be huge. I really appreciate all of the effort that you put into getting those things started. And it's really, really great that you have the support of other like-minded organizations to kind of continue that work and sort of pick up the mantle.
Yes. And they have much better funding than I do. And they have much more resources for hiring. And, you know, I love it when my projects are adopted. We have so many projects that are listed on our website, and yes, everything is available. Whoever wants to emulate it, whoever wants to copy it, we even offer to help them copy stuff. You know, like we have the Tree of Knowledge, and we offer to send kits if someone wants to put a Tree of Knowledge in their area. We'll send them a kit. We'll help them. We'll get things fabricated for them.
I love that you just brought that up, because this was one of the things that I just really enjoyed hearing you talk about at Gateway to Reason. And so I don't think that all of our listeners will be familiar with the Tree of Knowledge. So do you want to kind of give the background of that as well?
Sure, sure. Well, the Tree of Knowledge was an answer, we thought, locally to countering the religious symbols that were placed on the courthouse lawn in Chester County. And what was the norm was the creche and the menorah. And of course, there would be this, you know, Chamber of Commerce holiday tree with gifts all around it. So we submitted our idea that we would put up the same size tree as the Tree of Commerce, but our tree would have ornaments that exemplified our community. And so we busily made laminated color copies of the books that we hold dear as non-theists. But we also had copies of books of religion. So we put up the Bible, but right next to it, we had Bertrand Russell's Why I'm Not a Christian. That okay. book is right there. We put up the Torah, and right, you know, there we had secular Judaism, and we had Why I'm Not a Muslim. And so there were just all these books that we think are important for human beings to read and understand but we wanted to make sure that they knew we had a point of view as well. So there's history, you know, free thought history. There are our heroes, biographies of our heroes. Science is highlighted. Magic is highlighted. Skepticism is highlighted. And so we have this huge database of color copies of books. And now we can just go to our database and kick out these copies to make our ornaments. They're double-sided. And everyone is welcome to send us a PDF, a color PDF of their favorite book, and we'll make ornaments for them. So we were very successful for 3 years, but each year they were trying to figure out how to get rid of us. So they would pass an ordinance, you know, the tree can't be more than 9 feet, and then it couldn't be more than 6 feet, and then it could. And so it started to look like a bush.
Okay.
But they passed an ordinance that kept us out. I tried for 10 years to get us back in, and there's no budging them. But in the meantime, we've had Trees of Knowledge in Las Vegas, in Canada, in India, in Connecticut, Texas. I mean, you know, these smaller groups picked up on the idea. And I contend that the more Trees of Knowledge that are put up every year, it's a winter holiday symbol, that we can prove that the secular community has accepted it as a symbol. And then I can go back to the commissioners and say, this is our symbol. If you do not accept it, you are discriminating against a portion of the citizens you represent.
Right. And the discrimination would be coming from a place of religious privilege, which would violate the Constitution.
Yes. And, you know, over the years, I've had people come in to speak to the commissioners. I've had the military atheist. I've had Hispanic atheist. I've had Indian atheist. I've had humanist, ethical culturists, secular Jews, trying to show the commissioners that we are a rainbow of non-theism, that it's not just, you know, atheism. It's a wide variety, and it can only be represented in the books that we have on display.
Okay.
And so the commissioners just called them offensive.
Oh, and no.
What was so funny was that the same books were on display in the window of the bookstore around the corner.
Right. I mean, normally when you're fighting these battles, you aren't fighting logic and reason. So I guess that kind of not
you're
surprising.
Right. Yes. You're right.
So speaking of logic and reason, I was really happy to get you on the show this week because our main topic is superstition, and we are recording this on Friday the 13th.
Yes.
Which is so much fun.
I'm sitting under a ladder with my umbrella open and my black cat on my lap.
Well, I just broke a whole bunch of mirrors on the way in here, so I think we're good. But what I wanted to talk to you about is you being the founder of the Frigga Triska Decaphobia Treatment Center, which is amazing and fun. So what can you tell us about that?
Well, this idea came to us many, many years ago. What originally, you know, in Philadelphia, there was an old, old club, like from the 20s, where 13 members would get together on Friday the 13th and do something public, such as walking under ladders or holding umbrellas and, you know, just silly things on the sidewalk. And then they would have a 13-course meal, and they would have 13 people. So that was popular in Philadelphia for a long time. And the Center for Inquiry used to do a Friday the 13th event up in Amherst at their headquarters. Well, I took it one step further, and I developed this treatment center where the hosts were dressed as doctors and nurses, and people came in, and we cured them of any of their superstitions. And we did this by giving them CAT scans And
okay, now I'm imagining a CAT scan is you like waving a black cat over them.
That is correct.
Okay.
And we also, you know, had special guests like the amazing Randy, and you know, we've done this party in so many locations. In fact, Chicago used it to raise funds for the SPCA because we emphasized discrimination against black cats.
Okay.
So, you know, it's a great theme. It's a lot of fun. We have themed music. We have developed games over the years, such as Ladder Limbo. We have a pinata made like a ghost, and we play Ghostbusters when we break open. And, of course, we have the grand breaking of the mirror at a certain time. And the media loves it.
Right. And I can imagine. It just sounds like a lot of fun.
We have had television crews at our parties, journalists. We've been written up in the front page of the Philadelphia Inquirer, Time Magazine. Last year, CNN called me and wanted to do an interview, but I was getting ready for a party, and I said, I'm sorry, I can't do it. And they said, but this is CNN.
I said, okay, so what I'm hearing you say is the Wayward Willis podcast is more important and prestigious than CNN because we get you on Friday the 13th.
Right. I don't have a party planned this particular year. This year we tried to do it in Virginia, but we didn't have enough volunteers to make the party work. So that's what we need. When someone wants to put on a party in their area, I am more than happy to go there with costumes and ideas and different paraphernalia that we can ship and put on one hell of a bash. But they have to let us know a good year in advance so that we don't book other things. I did tell CNN I would be more than happy to do an April 13th interview if they gave me a day's notice. And they didn't. So there.
Okay. Well, I'm not sad about that. So speaking of hosting these parties and scheduling these parties, people can reach out to you at the Treatment Center, which is another link that I can provide in the show notes to schedule these and put them on, right?
Yes, we like to put them on to open up a conference. It's a really fun way to get the party moving.
Oh, right.
And so that's been a lot of fun. We've also been in Las Vegas we had a display at TAM. The Amazing Meeting. Have you ever heard of it?
I've heard of it. I have not been able to attend.
Well, they're gone now.
Oh.
They're no longer.
Okay.
We've opened up Logical in Los Angeles with a Friday the 13th. We've opened up our state conferences here in Philadelphia twice with one of our parties. But we also encourage people, you know, if you want to do one on your own, we'll help you long distance. Everything is up to be copied. We just don't want it to turn into something that isn't our vision. For instance, our costumes are very cute. They are not sexy. They are that is not the end game here.
Right.
We don't want sexy nurses. We want true to form, you know, nurses that are fun and cute and interesting. And we have doctors, we have woman doctors, and they, you know, are very stern about, you know, making people break a mirror and spill salt and get their CAT scan. We don't want it to turn into something that could be misconstrued.
Right. And I certainly understand that. But this all sounds like just a really great idea. And it is a shame that you don't have more Friday the 13th to do it.
This is true. And sometimes a Friday the 13th will fall in a very bad time of year. We had one in January one year, and boy, it was so difficult to set up the party with, you know, hauling things in the snow, and it was too close to the holiday. And so we did do a Friday the 13th in January in California. That we could do.
Okay, right. Yeah. Okay, so the treatment center is a fun idea, but it's also expressing a very serious view of the uselessness of superstitions. And so I guess my question to you is, why do you care and why should we care about helping people out of superstitions?
Because it's the first step to critical thinking. If you can convince someone to not look at their horoscopes every day,
right?
If you can convince people to not get, you know, their future determined by the numbers in their name or the letters in their name, by numerology or the date that they were born. I mean, that is such pure nonsense that if we can convince people that to take a second look and to ask why was I told to do this certain thing? If it makes sense, then do it. You know, superstitions sometimes were created for a reason. For instance, it's bad luck to put your shoes on the table. Well, duh. Yeah. You know, you're going to get hoof and mouth disease.
Right. That is not where your shoes go, people.
Right. So, you know, it's a superstition, but the reasoning behind it is understandable. Then you take it from superstition to rational thinking, critical thinking. And I think once you're down that road, you can easily start looking at other things like saint beliefs and other, you know, superstitions related to religion. We have one prop here in Philadelphia that we absolutely love, but every time we take it out to the ballroom, the staff is just taken aback and they stare at it and they look and they just, oh, they can't believe what we're doing. I took a mirror with a gold frame and I attached saint cards to the frame.
Okay.
I hot glued these saint cards all around the mirror. And on the mirror, it says, reflect on your superstitions.
Okay.
So that makes people think about their religious superstitions.
Yes.
And, you know, that's kind of a hard hitter.
Right. Because most religious people don't view their religion as a superstition. It's much larger than that to them.
Yes. And like, that's why we poke at it a little bit.
Right. Well, we poke at it a little bit as well. But yeah, I think that a lot of people, when they're thinking superstitions, they're thinking just, you know, little innocuous things. And they're just these small, little, harmless things that people do that, you know, why are we even worried about that? But superstition comes in all shapes and sizes, and it includes in its bubble religion.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I would say if the question is why should we care about helping people out of superstition, my answer would be, you know, because that mindset that can make you think uncritically about those tiny little things that don't hurt anybody could also open the door for you to adopt these much larger and more harmful beliefs.
And superstitions rob people's pocketbook. And they cause lazy thinking. You know, instead of looking at your problems and trying to figure out, you know, how to solve your problem, some people go and get their palms read or, you know, have their tarot cards read. And to us, you know, we want them to start thinking about those actions and questioning whether that's the right way to approach a problem.
Well, and not only that, but once you have paid the money to the psychic, you may be inclined to start living your life differently according to what they said, which is never advisable.
Right. Well, I don't call them psychics. I call them charlatans.
Well, yes, that would be the proper term.
And hopefully we can stop people from using horoscopes and zodiac signs to break people into categories. I mean, how can the position of a star dictate what your personality is or who you should be married to?
Right.
You know, some people consult zodiac signs just to figure out, can I be friends with that person or date that person? You know, what's your sign?
Right.
My sign is stop.
Yeah, I feel like these types of beliefs and this type of thinking could really make you miss out on the good things in life. I mean, if you're that scared of what somebody's zodiac sign is, which is ridiculous, then you could have had a wonderful friendship or a wonderful relationship or a wonderful marriage with that person, but you'll never know because you were just too scared. And that's right. Really sad.
Yes. And it also teaches people to actually divide on personality traits. And you know, the stars cannot bring out certain personality traits. Yes, you can broadly describe somebody, but if you put all those broad descriptions into a bag and had someone pull it out, 90% chance that they won't even pull out their right zodiac, but they'll say, oh, this describes me 100%.
Oh, yeah, it's so true.
Yeah, so true.
Right.
And we don't call them, we call them astrologers because we put an extra S in the name.
Oh, my goodness, you're cracking me up. Okay, so out of all of the superstitions that you know about, and I would venture to guess that you know about so many of them, what would you say is your favorite, either to poke fun at or you just think it's funny or cute? Which one's your favorite?
Well, you know, that would be so hard for me because when we prepare for our party, and I actually have an entire storage unit of props for our parties because each table has a centerpiece and it is a superstition.
Oh, okay.
And we also line the back walls of the ballroom with a museum of superstitions.
Oh, neat.
And so you can go to the party and learn about bean superstitions, lettuce superstitions, garlic superstitions. All of those will be on the food superstition table. And then animals, we break it into, you know, rabbits and birds and crows and, you know, all these superstitions related to animals, turtles, snakes, and household goods. We do that. And so I just have so much fun putting everything together that to ask me which one is my favorite is going to be lost because, you know, I even turned the Magic 8 ball into a critical thinking device. I have a Magic 8 ball on a table and you turn it over and it says, make up your own mind.
Oh, no, I love it.
So, you know, I just enjoy finding these obscure superstitions, making an educational sign about it. And then people come to our party and they can walk around and learn about whatever they are interested in.
That's so great.
Someday I hope to be on a cooking show and cook with somebody on Friday the 13th and talk about onions and superstitions related to garlic and, you know, all of those things about the salt and, you know, have fun with a chef as he and I or she and I are preparing a meal.
Well, I would support that.
13 people.
We need to lobby for that. Okay, so you have a quote that I read from R.E. Shea, and I just adore it. And it says, depend on the rabbit's foot if you will, but remember it didn't work for the rabbit.
Yes, and wait till you see our logo for the Frigatriskaidekaphobia Treatment Center. It was created by my dear friend Celestia Ward, and she sketched a rabbit missing his foot and on crutches.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, we have t-shirts with that logo on it.
Oh, I want one.
Yeah, people wear it on Friday the 13th. It's really cool. We have them in white and we have them in black.
Excellent. I'm going to have to get one of those.
Good.
So what is your favorite quote regarding superstition?
Well, since I'm from Philadelphia, I'll go ahead and tell you what my favorite Ben Franklin quote is.
Okay.
And that is, diligence is the mother of good luck.
And it's so true.
Yes, yes. Working hard, you know? You can change your luck because you're a hard worker and you want things to happen. So that's the way to change your luck.
Right. And the thinking critically piece. I mean, as skeptics and atheists and humanists, we like to think that we are somewhat in charge of our fortune. Yes. And that there is no such thing as luck. We kind of just make our own, right?
Absolutely. By making the right choices and by working hard.
Excellent. So I want to ask you, in kind of wrapping up, where you would like to send our listeners to find out more about you and all the organizations that you're involved with and the work you do.
Oh, I would love for people to visit the Free Thought Society website. We're celebrating our 25-year anniversary of our founding. And if they would like to leave a message on the website congratulating us, that would be so wonderful. And they can visit our committees. They could learn about our Helping Hands Committee. They could learn about the Tree of Knowledge. And of course, we're always here to help anyone.
Excellent. And I will definitely put that link in our show notes, and we will try and get people to check you out because it's a really good resource. And I definitely want to put a link directly to the Coming Out of Religion stories. And
there's a whole tab devoted to journey stories that we've received over the years.
Yes. And I think that that's very important for some of our listeners, where they might find that a very, very valuable resource. So we'll put all of that in the show notes. And
thank you, Jonathan. This has been so enjoyable. And I really appreciate you letting me talk about the committees, the projects, the parties. And it's been a lot of fun. Thank you.
Well, I've had a lot of fun, too. You are a wonderful guest. And I just wanted to thank you for sharing your time with us.
Thank you.
Mario Kart 8!
What are you buying?
Nobody exists on purpose. Nobody belongs anywhere. Everybody's gonna die. Come watch TV.
Teach me.
No.
Hello, people of alive status. Welcome.
Hey. What if they're like unalive?
I mean, they probably aren't very good at listening to podcasts.
You don't know.
You're right. I don't. Fuck. I take it back. I'm sorry, people of all statuses, alive or otherwise. Pick up your legendary helm and your rarest wand you can find, because this week we're talking about Diablo! Rather fitting, considering this week's topic, honestly.
Really? So, what even is Diablo?
Well, considering the game is only a year younger than I am, you should definitely know what it is, Grandpa.
What's that, Sonny? Speak up!
Okay, so old person jokes aside, Diablo is a game franchise published by Blizzard.
A Dairy Queen original! I like Butterfinger in mine.
Fuck you. No. Blizzard, the game shut up. The original Diablo was released in December of 1996, and it didn't take too long for it to boom in popularity. I'm gonna do this like a dumb school video, an instructional video.
Oh, God. That's,
according to most game websites and your friendly neighborhood Wikipedia, the game is boxed into the action role-playing hack and slash genre. However, the game has become so critically acclaimed and was so revolutionary when it was first released that the game's name has become an unofficial genre in and of itself.
Are you quite finished?
Yeah. I'm done with that.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
No, but seriously. So there are actually a handful of games on the marketplace that are now referred to as quote-unquote Diablo-likes because they share the same sort of gameplay style, the isometric perspective, sometimes even similar thematic elements. Basically, they're just like PIB games that are pretty much Diablo, but not really. But I think that you would be more interested in the game's lore, however.
So, when you say you, are you talking about me or the proverbial you?
I mean, specifically you, but shut up, I guess. I don't know.
Shutting up.
The lore for the franchise actually extends far beyond the games themselves, because the series gained a bunch of popularity. It spawned a collection of novels and comic books that all sort of delved far deeper into the world of Diablo than the games did. And the lore goes something like this.
And it goes a little something like this. Hit it.
No, I would have been more pleased with the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air intro, but also no. So just no all around. You're done.
Okay, fine, whatever.
Now it's your turn to be grounded. Anyway, in the beginning, there was but a single perfect pearl in which a being called Anu resided. Anu was the sum of all things, both good and evil. and upon considering itself, Anu sought total purity and consequently cast all evil from itself.
By pooping, obviously.
Okay, well, no, not by pooping. I don't exactly know how, but I'm sure it wasn't pooping.
Well, how do you cast all your evil from yourself?
By screaming and grunting really hard.
Okay, that sounds like pooping to me.
Moving on. Eventually, these discordant parts formed a new being called Tathamet. Tathamet was the first of the Prime Evils.
Sub-Optimus Prime.
No, this isn't off-brand Transformers.
Like GoBots?
Yeah, stupid GoBots.
Fuck you, GoBots.
So anyway, though Anu and Tathamet were separate beings, they were bound to one another within the Pearl. Of course, as in any good theological story, they immediately began to fight one another, but neither ever won out over the other. They fought for millennia until finally they expended the last of their energy. Their final blows ignited an explosion so violent that it caused the birth of the universe itself.
That is so much better than Superman and Doomsday punching each other to death.
Yeah, pretty much. Stupid. DC Comics, get your shit together.
DC bullshit, whatever.
Stupid, dumb DC.
Stupid, idiot.
Freaking.
Get your shit together!
So, the scar in the universe where this explosion originated became known as Pandemonium. There in Pandemonium, in the center of the universe, resided the Eye of Anu, otherwise known as the World Stone, dubbed the for its ability to create entirely new worlds.
Shit, that's no biggie. I create entirely new worlds in Minecraft every time a creeper blows me up.
Yeah, because there's just no point in continuing after that.
No shit.
Ugh, dumb creepers. Anyway, after the deaths of the two beings, pieces of them scattered throughout the universe. Anu's spine was launched into the primordial darkness, eventually forming the Crystal Arch over the course of several ages. Likewise, Tathamet's extra crispy flesh plunged into the depths of reality. These two remnants respectively formed the High Heavens, birthplace of the angels, and the Burning Hells, where demons spawned. In the High Heavens, Anu's virtues became embodied by archangels that formed the Angiris Council. In the Burning Hells, Tathamet's seven heads formed the Great Evils, the strongest three known as the Prime Evils, and the other four known as the Lesser Evils. Upon their conception, the angels and demons immediately launched into a battle known as the Eternal Conflict.
Sounds like some kind of cheap Ragnarok knockoff.
Basically, but okay. Also just, like, totally unsurprising, right?
Nailed it.
So both sides wanted to possess the World Stone's power. And to better defend the World Stone, one of the archangels on the Angiris Council, whose name was Tyriel, who was the aspect of justice, ordered a bastion to be built around it. This became known as the Pandemonium Fortress. Control of the fortress and subsequently the World Stone itself transferred back and forth between the two sides as they fought. One of the three prime evils was known as Mephisto, and he had a daughter named Lilith who grew weary of the never-ending battle.
That's kind of funny, because in literature, Mephisto is a Satan-like character, and Lilith is rumored to have been the first woman with Adam before she turned into a sex-crazed maniac and was cast out of the Garden of Eden to become a demon.
Yeah, actually, Lilith is referred to constantly as, like, the queen of the succubi.
Yeah, so there you go.
Literally just a demon who goes around fucking dudes and stealing their life essence.
It's a crossover episode.
Ding, ding, ding. So Lilith was so bored that she kidnapped an angel to keep as a plaything. However, the angel she took was different from the others. His name was Inarius, and he told her of his desires to escape the eternal conflict. Lilith could see that he could easily be manipulated, especially because of his blatant infatuation with her, so she convinced him that they could be lovers.
Sex-crazed maniac, duh!
Yep, and escape the conflict if he helped her steal the World Stone. The two of them gathered up some followers, and they pulled off the greatest heist of all time! They created a new world that they called Sanctuary, and they attuned the World Stone to cloak Sanctuary, hiding it from the High Heavens and the Burning Hells. And Arius was happy to finally have a place of respite away from the battle, but Lilith was determined to achieve victory. So, in an effort to convince Arius further, she let him writhe around on top of her and eventually birthed him a child.
Wait. Writhing around on top of someone is how babies are made? I feel like I've been doing this all wrong.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. You just squirm around like a worm.
Weird.
That's it.
Is there oil involved?
Nope.
Oh, I feel like you would just build up friction and get, like, sunburn.
I mean, nobody ever said that it was fun. Oh. Sex is not fun.
No.
Clearly, you don't know this.
Sex is not fun. Don't do it. You will get syphilis and you will die.
Abstinence is key. Oh, boy. So anyway, this child, the offspring of an angel and a demon, was known as a Nephilim.
Another Bible reference.
Ding, ding, ding. Soon, their renegade followers, angels and demons alike, all started boning each other. And before long, they had a little collection of Nephilim kiddos.
Okay, I actually am starting to really like this story.
Good.
It's like 50 Shades of Demon.
Oh, God. No. Never mind. I'm done. Pack it up. We're going home, boys. I don't know who the boys are, but we're going home.
All the boys.
Me and the rest of the boys. I'm going to go crack one open with them. So it didn't take long for all of these renegades to realize that their Nephilim offspring actually possessed stronger powers than any of them individually, and this was problematic in their eyes.
You know, I don't know about that. I've always wanted you boys to do better than I did.
Yeah, but did you want us to have superpowers that outscaled yours?
Fuck yes, I do.
That we could easily kill you with?
Yeah, I'm willing to make that sacrifice.
Wow.
I just
okay,
want
well...
you to be happy.
gee, thanks, Pop. So the renegades didn't want to be overthrown by their kids, nor did they want to draw attention to the secret world that they created, and infighting erupted, with some of them arguing that the Nephilim should be destroyed, and others arguing that they should be spared. And Lilith, of course, saw her powerful progeny as the future and the answer to the endless war. So she was driven mad at the prospect of people wanting to, like, bring out their extinction. So she morphed into this horrific form and went on a murderous rampage where she slaughtered all the renegade followers, leaving a horrified Inarius to cope with the aftermath while she played Diet Ash Ketchum to collect all the Nephilim.
Did she catch them all?
Yes, she did.
Okay.
But Inarius couldn't bring himself to kill his lover, so he banished her into the void instead. As a compromise between killing the Nephilim and sparing them, he basically attuned the World Stone once more for a new purpose. As each generation of Nephilim made their own children, the World Stone caused their powers to slowly weaken, eventually resulting in the formation of weaker mortals known as humanity.
And then Doctor Strange broke the World Stone into 6 gems that were spread throughout the universe, hidden from power-hungry Thanos.
That would be a cool crossover episode.
Right.
I'd like to see Diablo and Avengers crossed over. Let's make it happen. Do Blizzard, it. Marvel.
Do it.
Get on.
Do it, Dairy Queen.
Yeah, so... Fuck you. So not long after that, the Primevals learned of Sanctuary and they decided to get a piece of the action. Covertly, of course. They formed a cult called the Temple of the Triune, otherwise known as the Cult of the Three. Outwardly, the Triune was a benevolent religious body indoctrinating people, and their numbers rose dramatically. Inwardly, however, the Triune was just a way for the Primevals to enslave humanity and convert them to their side. The Triune flourished for 60 years before Inarius finally learned of its existence and the influence that the Primevals had over Sanctuary.
Okay, and hold up. So, we've been talking about millennia and endless eternal battles, and they throw in 60 years?
I mean, yeah.
That just seems like, I don't know, well, couldn't you have said like 6,000 years or something?
That's a really long time to have something going on right under your nose on a planet that you created.
Not when you've been alive for millennia. 60 years is like a second.
Well, yeah, but that's a, like an entire angel second of time where Inarius was just like, dur, 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 there's a giant cult forming on my planet and I don't even notice. Dur, 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 dur.
Is that what he sounded like?
Probably.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Although it was probably more dramatic. He was like, dur, 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 dur.
Okay.
So anyway, Inarius knew that he needed to put a stop to this cult forming, but he couldn't ask for help without bringing the attention of the High Heavens to Sanctuary as well, and turning it into a new battleground for the endless conflict, which obviously would have been counterintuitive for the creation of Sanctuary to begin with. So, in response, he swiftly formed a new cult, the Cathedral of Light, which was a rival religion. Eventually, his religion gained just as much influence, and then something surprising happened. The two religions broke out in an ideological battle, sparking what later became known as the Sin War.
What?
Yeah.
Color me surprised.
Ding, ding, ding. Unfortunately, Inarius didn't cross all of his T's and dot all of his I's when he banished Lilith, and she found a way to get back to Sanctuary amidst the Sin War.
Probably because he dotted his T's and crossed his I's. Okay, that pun works better in print.
Yeah, you're bad.
Actually, it may just not work at all. I'm stupid. Go ahead.
Yeah, you should feel bad about yourself.
I do. I feel bad about you, too.
Oh, gee, thanks. So when Lilith returned, she messed around with the World Stone's attunement to allow the Nephilim to gain their powers once more. She then disguised herself as a beautiful noblewoman named Lilia and enlisted the help of a lowly farmer named Uldisian. She convinced Uldisian that he had secret powers and that he should use them to take down both of the religious factions to bring free will back to humanity once more. Eventually, Uldisian discovered that Lilia was secretly Lilith in disguise, and she told him that he didn't actually have any powers, leaving him in a puddle of shame.
I feel like the whole Lilia thing is kind of like Clark Kent wearing glasses and nobody realizing he's Superman.
Okay, but like she literally shapeshifted and like I'm fairly certain probably possessed this actual real person.
Oh, okay, so it wasn't just a name change.
Gotcha. Oh, no.
All right.
No, yeah. Keep in mind that earlier she transformed into a giant horrific spider hoe and like slaughtered a shit ton of people with razor sharp claw things.
Stupid spiders.
Why couldn't it be full of the butterflies? later on, during a surprise encounter with a demon, Uldisian actually rediscovered Nephilim powers deep within himself, and he was reinvigorated, gathering his friends and building a group of followers with whom he awakened powers. This group became known as the Edirim, or Next Generation Nephilim.
It's kind of like a reboot of a movie franchise where they can't get the original cast.
Yeah, basically.
All right.
Star Wars Next Generation. Or Trek. Fuck.
You just lost so much nerd cred.
I am bad at everything. So it was then that Uldisian continued on his quest to eradicate both of the religious factions because he was basically like, I'm going to get back at Lilith and do this anyway, even though she told me that I couldn't. But he didn't really know that this was actually her plan the whole time because she was just coercing him the whole time.
Oh, shit.
But Uldisian actually defeated her eventually and he was wielding the powers that she actually bestowed upon him, and it was kind of funny. And then Inarius banished her again, but for real this time. She actually was super banished.
It's like super... she was permabanned.
Permabanned, yeah.
All right, gotcha.
Inarius swung the ban hammer.
The
and she
ban
was
hammer.
Gone. So the Edirim took down the Temple of the Triune, and then they set their sights on the Cathedral of Light.
And it sounds like this is where Indiana Jones comes in.
Basically, Mr. Jones! Dr. Jones.
You all wet, Dr. Jones!
But anyway, it was around that time that the High Heavens caught wind of Sanctuary. Just as Uldisian was preparing to do battle with Inarius himself, the Heavenly Host descended upon Sanctuary, determined to eradicate mankind, which they referred to as an abomination!
I don't actually disagree.
Yeah. Seeing no further reason to be inconspicuous, the Demon Legion rose up as well. And this resulted in the final battle of the Sin War, which was a three-way brawl between angels, demons, and Edirim.
So, does that mean the eternal conflict ended? Because, like, that's not very eternal, if you ask me.
No, it just means that the Sin War ended. The eternal conflict was still happening.
Oh, okay. All right.
Inarius just wanted to keep the eternal conflict out of Sanctuary.
Okay. I'm tracking now.
Gotcha. So, finally, Uldisian decided that enough was enough, and he basically went supernova in an attempt to terminate the conflict once and for all. And surprisingly enough, he was successful. The angels were all like, holy crap, I'm impressed by your sacrifice. And all the demons were like, oh shit, that dude is powerful as fuck. So yeah, the Angiris Council arrived, collectively deciding that mankind had merit, and they made the decision to leave Sanctuary to them as their homeland. And then Mephisto also appeared to make a pact with the angels, establishing that he and the demonic legion would also leave Sanctuary alone if the angels allowed him to keep Inarius as his prisoner. They complied, handing over the traitor, and their pact was established.
So this sort of sounds like the plot of Guardians of the Galaxy. Like Star-Lord goes supernova with the Nova Corps. I don't know.
I mean, good parallels. It's like that episode of Rick and Morty when he's like, it's like Old Yeller. And she's like, you mean because there was a dog?
Yeah. Like if there is one thing that's relatively similar, they're exactly the same thing.
Pretty much.
That's how I roll.
But anyway, you didn't think the demons really stuck to their word, did you? After all, the game series is called Diablo and I haven't even mentioned that guy's name once thus far. That's right, kiddos. If you want the rest of the lore, you're going to have to go play the games. Boom, roasted.
What even is lack of closure?
It's what you just got shoved in your face, bitch.
Shit.
I don't know. Maybe I'll be generous and make a part two at some point.
A part deux?
A part blah.
So if you had to rate Diablo on a scale of the death of Superman to Guardians of the Galaxy, what would you rate it?
Doctor Strange.
Okay. And having made it alive through another Friday the 13th, that's about all we've got this week. But I would be plagued by horrible luck if I didn't thank our patrons. So, Joe, Lisa McLean, Holly Vane, the Saratok Podcast, the Dumb All Over Podcast, Brothel Knight, Taro Tikkanen, and Corey Hill. If you cross your fingers and knock on wood, we'll have another episode for you next week. Until then, if you have questions or comments, please send us an email to podcast@waywardwillis.com. And before I close, I want to again let you know that we have a podcast survey for our listeners to give your feedback and make your voice heard. You can go to survey.waywardwillis.com. And please spread it around on social media and make sure everybody gets to see it. Intro music was provided by Austin Cologne and used with permission. You can find more of Austin's music linked in the show notes. This podcast is a media production of Willisware LLC. All rights reserved.
This has been The Wayward Willis. If you liked what you just heard and you want more of John and Logan, you can follow us on Twitter @WaywardWillis, Facebook @facebook.com/TheWaywardWillis, or at WillisWeb.com. If you want to help the show and have a few extra dollars, you can donate per episode or per month on Patreon at patreon.com/wayward. We'll be back next week.